Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I'm pretty well set with what I'm growing, partly because I've scaled so back so much. But I did expand my garlic a little bit this year, and I'm cutting back my carrots a little bit this year.
It's planting season, and for some farmers, the decisions they make today will determine whether or not their business turns a profit this year. We go to northern Colorado, where a new cheese factory is changing the farming landscape in some significant ways. Daniel Orr's high-powered blender is the MVP of our two recipes, his vegetable-heavy take on cookout food. And then we meet Denise Rackley. She raises sheep and lambs with the help of some highly trained border collies, but her dogs are more than just extra help around the farm. Food and farm stories with Mr. Mark Chilla.
Not the best news this week about obesity rates among American children. New data shows that there has been a steady increase in obesity rates in kids ages 2 to 19 between 1999 and 2014. 33% are overweight, and 17% are obese. Allison Aubrey of NPR's The Salt spoke with study author Ashley Cockrell Skinner, a researcher at the Duke Clinical Research Institute at Duke University. Skinner also points to a continued increase in the rate of severe obesity among teens, which rose 6% from 99 to about 10% in 2014. Obesity rates are also up in rural China. The authors of a new study are calling it a serious public health problem. It's especially severe for boys in the rural Shandong province, where the percentage of overweight and obese boys jumped to 30% in 2014. Back in 1985, it was one half of 1%. What's behind the spike? Researchers suggest Western diets and sedentary lifestyles are to blame. But China is also getting richer, which researchers say could mean children have more access to more food. Food Safety News is reporting a possible listeria contamination in frozen food sold at Costco's in Canada. Organic by Nature brand frozen sweet peas are the culprit. Earlier this month, Costco Wholesale Canada recalled Nature's Touch brand organic berry cherry blend linked to a hepatitis A outbreak. And this week, Chipotle announced its first ever quarterly loss. That's despite increased advertising, more hours for its staff, and a marketing campaign that gave customers millions of free burritos. Last year, the fast casual chain saw outbreaks of E. coli, norovirus, and salmonella. Shares dropped 47% from October to January as illnesses in Boston, California, and the Pacific Northwest were tied to Chipotle. Despite this current financial bump in the road, the Chicago Tribune reports that Chipotle plans to open between 220 and 235 new stores this year. Links to these stories have been compiled in the podcast post on our website. Thanks to our bloggers, Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killo.
And you don't have to pay a subscription fee to read the articles on our website, eartheats.org. So, you know, stop on by. Mark Chilla is online from time to time. You hear him every week at the top of the show.
See you next week.
Planting season is underway from backyard gardens to the vast fields of the Corn Belt. As farmers put seeds in the ground and their confidence in another crop season, they know they'll get just one shot at making their business profitable this year. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer talked to farmers in the field about the opportunities they're grabbing.
After a light rain the night before, Josh Nelson watches a bright red Case Magnum 340 tractor pull a 24-row planter and crest a small hill. It's dropping corn seed at careful intervals.
A tractor's kind of neat because it's you got these fans and it's kind of it doesn't sound like a traditional tractor.
Nelson says his family farm has dodged a weather bullet this week, but it's just one of many hurdles this season promises. Nelson farms with his father, uncles, and a cousin in North Iowa. This year, the Nelsons are growing a new product they hope will make a little more money.
One of the things that we're doing this year is we're growing a certain kind of corn that's specifically designed for ethanol production.
They'll get a premium price for it, as long as they keep it separate from the other types of corn they're growing. They spent the winter calculating exactly what to grow, and now they're committed.
Here he comes.
Imagine if you ran a restaurant, but you had to order absolutely all of your ingredients in April. No way to know how many customers you'll have or what they'll order. That's the kind of risk the Nelsons and other farmers have to juggle.
Last year I had all of these filled clear up, three flats.
Nelson came back to join the farm in late 2012. That's about when the markets started to tumble. Economists expect corn this year to fetch some of the lowest prices in nearly a decade. Nelson says to make it work, each farmer in his family has to leverage a little something extra out of the business.
On my own operation, I've got about a half acre of produce. I sell through a producer cooperative in Mason City. And then another one of my uncles raises hops and barley for local beer.
In a restaurant, you might open a catering arm to find that extra business. You'd probably use a computer to track your inventory as farmers document their past crop yields and expenses. And you might bring in a consultant to figure out how best to anticipate the year.
You got to have a lot of outside help, you know, somebody that has that outside perspective. We talk a lot with our banker.
Just up the road from the Nelson farm, Dennis Sloth is vice president of First State Bank in Belmont, Iowa. Despite lower prices and a gloomy outlook from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which says farm income will be down again this year, Sloth says he has not had to rewrite a single farm loan.
Yeah, I think we're actually in very good shape.
Sloth says during the good years, farmers paid down debt and put money into savings. They need to continue with that prudence.
Our farmers will get through this, but they all have to be really aware that, you know, you do need to make a profit farming.
Like other business owners facing down times, some farmers have been cutting back expenses, even giving up fields they've been renting, a rarity in a business that prizes high-quality land.
My name is Gary Guthrie, and this is our family farm that we just celebrated 50 years on the farm last year.
But Guthrie's family has always had tenants farm the crop acres here in Nevada, Iowa. So far, that's still working out. After coming back, Guthrie did community-supported agriculture on 2 acres for many years. That business got too big. So now he focuses on just a few vegetables.
I'm pretty well set with what I'm growing, partly because I've scaled back so much. But I did expand my garlic a little bit this year, and I'm cutting back my carrots a little bit this year.
Guthrie cares about corn and soybean prices because his row crop acres have to make money to keep the whole thing afloat. And he needs buyers for all his veggies. But when he makes planting decisions, he's not thinking only about money. Time also matters.
If I plant something, it means work. Is that work worth the work that I'm going to put into it, and what am I going to get out of it?
Business owners make decisions like these all the time, but they usually have the option to change course throughout the year. Farmers really don't, and that makes planting decisions feel particularly fraught, especially in a lean economy. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Another Harvest report later about how a new cheese factory is changing the way some Colorado farmers go about their business. In the kitchen now, Daniel Orr is making guacamole and burgers. Sort of. I like to think of these recipes as great ways to use up the extra stuff in your kitchen, whether it's that bunch of mint that's been slowly wilting, or the last little nub of ginger, or that box of falafel mix that you just never got around to cooking. So, he's starting with the guacamole-inspired dip. It's green and thick, yes, but check out these ingredients.
What I like about the sweet peas is that it's very low in fat. It has a really nice sweet flavor. And I take it, another step by adding the tofu, which adds a nice protein source. So it's very lean, but it has a lot of flavor in it. And it's so simple. All you need is a good blender. I'm going to add some silken tofu, which is the soft tofu. All right, so we have that. We're going to add the sweet peas. And these sweet peas have just been blanched, which means cooked in some boiling salted water until the skins become tender. And then we shock them in ice water. I'm going to add a little bit of extra virgin olive oil. I'm going to add some garlic. And a lot of times you'll see garlic that has this little green sprout coming out of it. And that's the germ of the garlic. It's the plant actually trying to grow. All right. And what you want to do is you want to remove that. And the reason you do that is if people have problem digesting garlic, it's usually this is what they're having trouble with. Okay, I've got some chopped ginger. You just kind of do a rustic cut. It's going to be pureed anyhow. I added a nice handful of mint, which is going to take it to another level of flavor, and some hot sauce. All right, and then basically it's just a matter of pureeing it. Okay, we have a really nice smooth consistency now, and I'm going to add a little fresh cracked pepper. I always use fresh pepper. Okay, a little bit of kosher salt. Place some of our homemade corn tortilla chips. Decorate it with a little fresh mint sprig. And I think that that could go in one of the posh's dining rooms or right in front of the TV.
Toasted pita slices go nicely with this dip. Pita will also serve as the bun for our burger. It's a veggie burger that you can customize pretty easily. For instance, if you have some leftover grilled veggies from last night's cookout, you could chop those up and toss them in. The basic outline of the recipe goes like this.
We're going to make the base of it with some white beans. Just going to put those in your food processor with a little bit of egg white. And egg white will be the binder. So when this cooks, the egg whites will harden. Okay, to that I'm going to add some fresh herbs. You can use whatever you want, basil, parsley, cilantro. We're just going to run the machine until it all comes together as a paste. You could add falafel mix to this, which is something you can buy in a Middle Eastern grocery store, or you could just add some freshly cooked grains like I have here. In my grain mix, I've got some lentils, barley, quinoa, millet. Got some diced tomatoes, some sautéed or grilled mushrooms. They add that kind of meatiness to the burger. And finally, I'm going to add some scallions. And, you know, the vegetables and the tomatoes will release some moisture. You know, if you're using falafel mix, that will absorb the excess moisture. Or if you don't have falafel mix, you can add breadcrumbs. I'm going to scatter a few of those breadcrumbs down on a little cookie sheet. And then there's lots of ways you can cook them. You could bake them in the oven. Or you could sauté them in a nonstick pan with a little bit of olive oil would be good. I've got some nice whole wheat pita. Split that in half, make some pockets out of it. And then you could add whatever you want. If you want to, you could add a little bit of hummus in there, some red pepper sauce, mustard, ketchup, whatever you want.
We've got a recipe for ketchup at eartheats.org. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know that I always try to mention one of my favorite sauces of all time, the beet vinaigrette. That's what Daniel Orr served the burger with. Bright pink and delicious. Give these recipes a try and let us know how they turn out. Our email is eartheats@gmail.com. Coming up.
You know, my dogs are in when I'm in and outside when I'm outside. And at 10 at night or 4 in the morning, they're right there with me. They don't complain if it's raining or if it's muddy or if it's cold or if it's snowing. I depend on them for everything.
Denise Rackley and her team of dogs. We go to a sheep farm after this. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats here. I'm Annie Corrigan. When a big food company builds a factory, it doesn't just bring new industry. Farmers change what they grow, expand their herds, and buy new land. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon found out, a new meatpacking plant or dairy company can quite literally change the landscape around it.
Casey DeHaan's dairy farm near Ault, Colorado looks pretty standard from the county road it sits on. Big red barn, pen full of cows. But inside, those cows are filing onto a huge metal merry-go-round.
So what are we looking at?
So this is a, they call this a rotary parlor. It's all always moving, and the cows get on and off.
These dairy cows are being milked while the spinning machine inches along. The cows look quizzically down at us while DeHaan shows me around.
By the time the cow makes one revolution, she's completely done milking, and she goes back to the pen and watch your head.
We duck under the machine as it continues to turn above us. DeHaan's been up and running here for 8 years after moving to Colorado from his home state of California. And lately, he's been growing his herd.
We went from 3,000 cows to 4,000 cows. You know, at that time, the Prina was wanting more milk as well, you know, so it worked out. And ultimately, we're shipping more milk down the road to the plant.
Catch that name? La Prina. It's a Denver-based mozzarella cheese manufacturer, the largest in the world. The plant near DeHaan's dairy is just a few years old and takes in nearly all the milk DeHaan's 4,000 cows churn out, plus much of the milk his neighboring dairy farmers produce. Mike Reedy is a La Prina executive.
There's a good chance if you go buy a bag of frozen mozzarella, shredded mozzarella in the grocery store, that it's our cheese.
La Prina's cheese is ubiquitous, on everything from Papa John's pizza to frozen dinners. And to make it, they need a lot of milk. Already, their plant in Greeley, Colorado, takes in millions of pounds of milk a day. Now, it's about to expand. And to do that, the company will need a lot more cows nearby.
Generally, the number we've been sharing with folks is about an incremental 30,000 cows.
Since the late 90s, the number of dairy cows in northern Colorado has more than doubled. Tom Herron helped make that happen. He's the CEO of Ag Professionals, a consulting group in northern Colorado that helps farmers expand their operations or find locations for new farms.
Does it have the water? Does it have the land, regulatory environment, political will, the interest in the farmers and the people? Does it have a market?
Herron says most new dairies here are popping up within an 80-mile radius of the expanding La Prina plant. Because milk can spoil quickly and shipping it in big refrigerated trucks is expensive, dairy farmers want their farms close to the companies who are buying their milk and the people in cities who drink it.
But we're also dealing in agriculture, and particularly with milk, with a perishable commodity. So how long can you sit on it before it becomes something that isn't usable?
In many ways, our food system is regional. You'll find big cattle feedlots near companies that produce hamburger meat and big hog farms near bacon factories. Farms cluster around the factories that process their products. Factories move closer to their suppliers. And the placement of a new factory can spur even more growth.
I mean, the trickle down on this is huge.
Changes to a region's agricultural makeup don't come without costs. The growing dairy region of Colorado is also seeing dramatic population growth. Water is limited. And many of the new and expanding dairies are finding themselves positioned near or within suburban communities. You can see some of those rapidly growing neighborhoods from Casey DeHaan's dairy farm. When he was designing his operation, he tried hard to cut down on odors from manure and muddy pens. He's looking to expand further to meet La Prina's thirst for milk.
8 million pounds of milk a day. You know, they're knocking on the door now, wanting to get to that point. And so I think the Colorado dairymen and will do everything they can to help make that happen for them.
And as they do, they'll be rewarded with a market ready for more. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Connect with Luke and all the reporters at Harvest through their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Now to a sheep farm in southern Indiana, where new lambs are joining the flock all the time. It promises to be a busy spring for farmer Denise Rackley. And she tells us she couldn't make it all work without the help of some furry farmhands.
Mm.
Denise uses a cane to get around her farm. She has a brace on her right knee, but she says it's a pre-sheep injury. It's like she's moving in slow motion, guiding a couple baby lambs to join the herd.
I have to get these two guys. Hey, you're going the wrong way, buddy.
It's early April in Indiana, but it's very cold and windy, and even a little snowy, on her farm down near the Ohio River. It's 100 acres total, the cropland she rents out, the woodland she leaves alone, and the pasture land is for the sheep. She has about 80 ewes right now that are lambing. Most of them have numbers spray-painted on their backs with matching numbers on their lambs so she can keep them all straight. Hello, number 34. Inside the barn now. It's loud. Sheep are loud. But Denise's dogs are quiet. A handful of border collies lay in their cages, looking up at us as we walk by. She opens one of the crates.
This is Meg. She's 5 years old. She was born and raised and trained here. So I'll use Meg to bring the new mom and lamb up to put behind the barn with the others.
Now the other dogs start whining. Denise says they're jealous they weren't chosen for the job. The lamb she needs was born overnight. Meg's task is to separate the lamb and the ewe from the rest of the herd.
Lie down.
Meg is shaking with anticipation. And now it's more quiet than it's been all morning.
Not a girl.
Denise says border collies are naturally quiet when they work, which is good, because barking dogs make sheep nervous. Denise closes the gate. She gives Meg the okay to start her approach, and the sheep scatter.
Come by!
That means go clockwise around the animals. Away is counterclockwise.
Not a girl. Lie down. Easy, girl.
Meg drops to her belly. She's isolated the ewe and its new lamb. Denise gives commands to bring her slowly around, coaxing the animals to go through the gate in a holding pen.
Not a girl. Time.
And now Meg trots off to drink from a trough of water.
There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
Denise grabs the lamb and wraps a band around its tail. That tail will fall off in 2 to 3 weeks. Then it's a dash of purple spray paint. This ewe and her lamb get the number 43. Denise has been working with dogs almost as long as she's been a rancher. She's from Cincinnati, but moved to South Dakota in 1998 to work on a ranch. A neighbor there told her how helpful dogs can be when working with livestock, so she got a puppy and trained it. Or rather, the dog trained Denise. That was Luke. Together, they tended a flock of 50 ewes. Their first real test as working partners came when there was a birth on that ranch.
On the ranch where I lived, they had purebred cattle. They had Hereford cattle. And I was always all right going out, checking cattle, take the four-wheeler, go check on calves being born, record it in the calving book and get an ear tag ready. And so I was there on the ranch alone that weekend. So I went to check cattle and told him to stay at the barn because a dog, just like the sheep don't necessarily like a dog with their lambs when they're really young, the mama cows would be upset with a dog coming in to the pasture with young calves. So I had to ask him to stay at the barn, which he did. And I drove down on the four-wheeler, and this mama had a burr up her butt. And I got off the four-wheeler, walked over toward the calf. She hit me with her head, knocked me down, and was grinding me into the dirt with her head and stepping on me. I was on this ranch by myself, far enough away from the neighbors that they weren't going to hear me screaming. And the fence behind me was barbed wire and rather low to the ground, and I didn't think I could get under it or through it. And the four-wheeler was behind her, so that wasn't going to help me. Luke came from the barn, flew between the cow and I, bit her on the nose as he went, and so she turned because he was now a bigger threat than I was, and she went after him, and I got up out of the way. It was not lost on me that it probably saved me at least from an ER visit, if not saved my life. That instilled in me, I suppose, a great respect for just what they're capable of and what they're willing to do for me.
Eight years ago, Denise's father died. Her mother didn't want to sell their farm, and she didn't want to live alone, so Denise said if she could bring Luke with her and start raising sheep on the property, she'd move back home. According to 2012 USDA data, her farm is now one of only 14 sheep operations in Switzerland County, Indiana. Here, by the junction of Indiana, Kentucky, and Ohio, Denise feels isolated.
I really liked it out west, just because the lifestyle, the people, it's more agriculturally centered. That changes how people relate to each other. They're very dependent on neighbors, and there's more of a community type setting there. Here, you have to pretty much do it all yourself. So that makes it harder.
It also felt more comfortable for her to be a single woman running her own farm when she lived in South Dakota. She's only one of 38 women listed as a principal operator of a farm in Switzerland County. She says her dogs take the place of several people in farm work and, it seems, in companionship. Denise also breeds border collies. She sells most of them, but keeps a select few to train to work with her sheep. Her youngest is Ziva. She's about a year and a half old. Ziva and Luke shared time on the farm, just briefly.
When dogs get to, 10, 12, 13, they start slowing down. So as they're heading for retirement, basically, you have to have a young one coming up. So you have that bond with another dog while you're kind of letting go of the older one.
Was she born around the same time that he died?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait. Get. Wait. Shh. Atta girl. Walk up. Atta girl.
We posted a series of photos showing Denise and her dogs on the farm at eartheats.org.
Ziva. Good girl.
Appreciation to the Earth Eats team. We've got Eabon Binder and Betsy Shepherd who work on the website. Our bloggers are Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow. Thanks to Mark Chilla as well. And of course, the team of reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Hope to see you on the website or on the Twitter feed. Find us at Earth Eats. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.